Welcome to this, our third sonic session for the University of Brighton course, Media and Popular Culture. And today, we really do follow the bouncing ball. Yes, we explore the nature of sport, leisure, and physical culture. We also investigate the systems and models of inclusion and social exclusion that are formed in and around the body. I'm Tara Brabazon, and thanks for joining me again. Today, let's think about who we are when we move and how we judge those who do not. Sport, fitness, diet, and health are booming topics in the publishing industry and in the media more generally. New areas of journalism are emerging that focus on health news, food news, and the sports media. But before we deal with these success stories, I have a more preliminary question for you. What is sport? And how is sport different from exercise, fitness, and entertainment? Sport involves some degree of organized physical exercise. So both aerobics and wrestling are organized, they have rules, they have administrators, and involve physical exercise and movement in a way that chess does not. But there is a second definition of sport, and that is that it is a spectacle in which an audience watch and views more expert performers. So within this definition, wrestling is still a sport, but only particular forms of competitive aerobics are a sport. At a world championship level, yes, aerobics is a sport, but our daily aerobics classes with Lycra in tow are not sports. Instead, aerobics in that context is fitness. So jogging is fitness, running a marathon is a sport. Driving on a motorway is not a sport, but driving in a 500cc motorcycle championship is. But then of course there are interesting cases like, say, professional poker. Work out in your mind if professional poker is a sport. So we've worked out sport requires an audience. But as we've been thinking about throughout this course, theories of media audiences, consumerism, and spectatorship are changing. All audiences, but particularly sporting audiences, are increasingly mediated through television. Throughout much of sporting history, but particularly through the 20th century, sport was seen as a site for masculine socialization. Ooh. But through television, the constraints and the social pressures on who watch sports and why people watch sport have been loosened. In Australia, of course, the best example of this loosening of who watches sport and why has occurred in cricket. In the United Kingdom, cricket is a masculine, white and middle-class sport, Freddie Flintoff and Monty withstanding. But through the innovations of Kerry Packer's cricket in Australia, new audiences were brought to the game through television and through the extraordinary innovations of television commentary. Think about Richie Benaud. The one-day game and 2020 matches have transformed who watches cricket, how cricket is watched, and how it is broadcast. Therefore, television is changing how we think about sport and how men and women engage with it. But there are consequences for this media investment in sport. There's been an increasing division between elite and grassroots players. The problem is that the academic analysis of sport frequently concentrates on elite activities, that is, professional sport, and rarely asks questions of the social access of particular groups to specific sports. So very few studies look at sport as an institution, if you like, as an agent of socialization. Sport teaches us about who we are, whether or not we belong, or if we are excluded. So my goal for you today is to develop a more expansive way for you to think about and see sport. I want us to think about how we can change people's access to and experience of physical activity in a way that makes it more fair, more just, and more pleasurable. Governments, you see, subsidise particular sports and not others. As we've already shown, some areas are defined as sport, but others are called fitness or leisure or entertainment. But really, the definitions are not that clear, and certainly they're historical. They change. Class has a strong relationship with our definition of sport, fitness, health, and exercise. There is a literacy of health and fitness, but it's also a question of opportunity. The person with money can afford gym memberships, they maybe live in a suburb with plenty of parks, and have friends who undertake regular exercise. But you might like to compare that to the life of a person who may be a single parent, locked in a part-time job, fatigued from work, lives in a poor suburb with few parks, or can't afford a sport or an exercise club membership. So this lack of exercise or sporting membership is not a question of laziness, but a question of opportunity. So while we've got to focus on what individuals need to do to lose weight, when we do that, we also let governments and local councils and employers off the hook. And that's why our session today involves us thinking about that government document, A Sporting Future for All, and also that very impressive report by Adam Brown and others for the Football Foundation that's titled Football and Its Communities. Now that last report, Football and Its Communities, allowed researchers to enter into particular communities and show what is going wrong and what is going right in the development of sport and physical culture in poor and deprived areas. There are assumptions that sport is good for people, and that's why physical education is such a contested topic in schools, involving a cluster of personal skills that are supposedly developed through sport. You know this stuff, you build character, you develop social skills. But is this really the case? My issue for you to think about today is we've got this automatic ideological connection between sport and positive outcomes. There are plenty of assumptions, ideologies, if you like, about people who are involved in sport. There is an assumption that a few people, whether they be sport policy makers or phys ed teachers, think that they know what is best for other people. And that's why, for example, it's so important in the popular press that sports people are good role models. Now, I'd imagine a lot of us, hands up me included, had shocking experiences at primary school or high school with sport. Don't know about you, but I have dreadful memories about being shouted at by some crazy phys ed teacher barking that I should be running around a field. But the assumption I want us to question today is the notion that sport intrinsically or automatically makes a good person. The notion that government funding for elite sport is meant to inspire the rest of the country to get involved in sport and exercise is really the basis of all the funding for sport in the last two decades. But really, there's little evidence for this. Therefore, we really need to question the high level of governmental support for elite sport at the expense of community programs. Now, don't get me wrong on this. Money put into elite sport does work. If you want to win a gold medal at the Olympics, they can be bought. They can be bought particularly in sports like rowing, gymnastics, swimming, and cycling. So if you put money into those sports, you will get results at an elite level. But there is no evidence to connect elite sporting success with increased grassroots participation. We have to stop this connection. We have to stop this assumption. If we want people to get off the couch and exercise, then very precise policies have to be put in place to do this. We assume that participation in sport is enough. We don't give much thought to how sport is taught, how it is coached. The supposed magic of sport is that it turns mad, ill-disciplined and fat children into good, healthy citizens. But of course, physical activity is not a cure for social problems. Instead, class determines the amount and form of physical activity undertaken. Through the 19th century, particularly in England, the games of the rich were not the games of the poor, and most of the games of the poor have disappeared. The arrival of the middle class through the Industrial Revolution created new forms of recreation that were different from the lower classes. So working class leisure became a problem, physically dangerous, attracting large street crowds. So the upper class then made these sports morally inferior. And that's why fox hunting has survived for so long, while dog fighting, cock fighting and live bait dog racing have been banned because these were working class sports. All these debates that we're talking about today have an impact on which sports and physical activities are taught in schools. The goal, therefore, is not simply the development of physical or motor skills, but the teaching of the value of competition and the ability to fit in with a group through the teaching of rules. So, start to think about who gains from the definition of sport. Start to think about a wider array of physical cultures and think about who is controlled and disciplined through the rules, the training, and the affirmation of competition, of winning, of losing. You must ask yourself, when we celebrate and validate a winner in sport, what are we suggesting about the loser?